Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. In the Ask the Experts portion of the University of California Berkeley Wellness Letter, the topics run the gamut from the nutritional value of nut butters to deductibles on colonoscopies to stool softeners and more. The latest issue also tackles topics such as how to get a blood pressure reading right, the dairy diabetes debate, and how to read nutrition labels to make sure foods don't contain trans fats. Joining us now is the chair of the editorial board for the Wellness Letter, Dr. John Swartzberg. He's going to talk about medical issues of the day and what you need to know. Welcome to the show, Dr. Swartzberg.
Thank you for having me.
For our listeners, if you do have a question for Dr. Swartzberg, please give us a call, 614-292-8513. Dr. Swartzberg is clinical professor of health and medical science at the University of California, Berkeley, and as I said earlier, chair of the editorial board for the UC Berkeley Wellness Letter. Dr. Swartzberg, first of all, what is the Wellness Letter? Where did it come from, and who's it for?
It came from an idea generated by a publisher in New York and the dean and another professor at UC Berkeley about 25 years ago, and it was at that time, a fairly unique idea that information from the School of Public Health and from around the country and around the world that would pertain to people's health and wellness really needed to be better disseminated and translated in a way that was easily accessible.
It started out as a book, right?
Well, it started out both as these monthly publications that we've continued, and then periodically books that were compiled from these publications and more. The books had to do with the topics that we addressed in the Wellness Letter and then morphed into other books about healthy eating and diets and so on.
How do you decide what gets in the Wellness Letter every month? There's never, there's no lack of topics, I guess, because every letter's so different.
Right. Well, we live in an information society, so you're right. There's no lack of topics. One of the main sources of our topics is, of course, what's happening in the medical literature at that time. So I and my colleagues at Berkeley are looking at the literature on a regular basis and picking out topics that we think would be important for the public. In addition, though, we get a lot of letters from our readers asking questions, and those are a rich source of ideas for topics. And then our writers give us some very good ideas as well. So we have them from multiple sources.
I want to get to some of the topics that are in recent wellness letters, news and expert advice from the School of Public Health. But first, I wanted to talk about something that a lot of people are struggling with in central Ohio right now. The temperature is supposed to get up to 99 degrees today. Heat stroke, problems with heat, that sort of thing are a big concern, particularly because so many people are still without power from the storm last week or over a week ago. What are the warning signs of heat stroke? What should people be looking for? How much should they hydrate? What should they do to protect themselves?
Yeah, well, you're right. It's an incredibly important topic and so timely right now. On a personal level, I've been talking with my daughter and her family on a daily or twice daily basis. They live in Arlington, Virginia, and they've been without power. Actually, they got their power on finally last night. And so I've been sort of living vicariously through their struggles. The important issue about heat stroke is that there are lots of warning signs that are subtle, and people need to pay attention to those. You don't want to wait until you just can't get up off the floor where you pass out. And I think some of the earliest things are weakness, just feeling very tired. And that's something that people often sort of think they can just work through. But with heat stroke or with overheating, that often is not possible. So I think that's a very early sign. People may stop perspiring, which can be a sign of impending problems. And, of course, not making a lot of urine. So some of the things that I think are really key to preventing this from happening are the obvious. And the most important of the obvious is to maintain really excellent hydration. And that's pretty easy for a lot of us because a good parameter is to just look at the urine you make. And if it's dark yellow, you're not getting enough fluid. So you want to have your urine looking as clear as possible. So just drink until you're making urine that's as clear as possible. A caveat to that, though, is that as people age, the kidneys and the body just doesn't respond to fluid changes as well as when we're younger. So you can't necessarily depend upon that. And as people age, you can't depend upon thirst, which is, of course, a major tool we use for hydration. So older people may not get thirsty when they really need to take in fluid, whereas younger people will have that message in their brain and be drinking. So older people need to discipline themselves more to just be taking in fluid on a regular basis.
Can anxiety be a sign of distress from the heat?
Sure. Anything that fatigue I was talking about is a real generic term. And anxiety, agitation are certainly feelings that people get when they're getting way behind in fluids and their body temperatures are going up.
I ran a race, you know, one of those obstacle course races a few years back, and for the first time ever, I got the chills. It was about 90 degrees out, 5-mile race, and I got the chills. Is that a sign of anything? I stopped running, I'll tell you that.
It's a sign of probably stopped running, right?
Yeah, right.
You know, a lot of the feelings we get when our body temperatures are much too high are related to what's called the autonomic nervous system. And characteristically, it's going to give funny symptoms to us. And chills would be a possibility, although I've got to say a little less typical than most of the symptoms from high body temperatures.
So let's talk about what's in the wellness letter. The lead story in the wellness letter for July is blood pressure and how to get a correct reading. And typical results, it says, the ones that most of us get after a quick reading in the doctor's office are usually off. By how much and what do we do to change that?
Well, if you've got really, really high blood pressure, this is probably not a major issue. But most people who have high blood pressure, which is an awful lot of us, have what's called stage 1 high blood pressure, which is just a little bit over normal. And this is the area where it's really critical that we get these numbers right. And we took a lot of this article from the American College of Cardiology's recent statements about measuring blood pressure. And here are some of the details, because it really is the devil in the details in this case. It's important that you be in a sitting position, not in a lying position, that you be in a room that's quiet, where there's no distractions, for at least 5 minutes before the blood pressure is taken. It's important that while the blood pressure is being taken, you're not in a dialogue with the nurse or doctor or other healthcare professional. It's important that both arms are checked, at least initially, because sometimes there can be significant differences between the arms, and sometimes those differences can reflect some other kind of problem. So those are some of the tips that are really important for people to know. The other thing is that because there's such variation in our blood pressure on a moment-to-moment basis, and because there is variation in how blood pressures are being measured, if you're at that borderline level before starting to take medication, it's important to really know if your blood pressure is high. And there are now these really good home monitors that people can have for 24 or 72 hours that can give a relatively continuous measurement of your blood pressure. And those are much more accurate and often show that, hey, you don't really have high blood pressure and you don't need to take the medication.
You know, you mentioned both arms. I don't think I've ever had both arms done.
It's interesting. I teach medical students, and we teach them to do that, and that's in all the standard physical diagnosis textbooks. But I don't think I've ever had both arms done when I've gone to see a physician either. It's something that isn't regularly done. Now, I don't think it has to be done every time, but it's important that it's done at least once to make sure that you're not somebody who has a significant difference between those arms.
And also, isn't a lot of this information for the healthcare professional? Because most of us get it done when we go to the doctor's office. I mean, you can get it done like at the pharmacy nowadays. They have those machines. But most of us still do it with a doctor or a nurse or a nurse practitioner or some kind of healthcare professional.
Right. We actually debated. Yeah. We debated putting this doing this article because it the we were concerned and still have a little concern that this is a message to healthcare professionals, but we decided it's also a message to the patient and to try and empower the patient to speak up, which is hard to do with your healthcare professional. It's hard to say, hey, doc, you know, you should be doing it on both arms now, or I should be sitting here relaxing for 5 minutes and not lying down, that kind of thing. So that's hard to do. But nevertheless, I think it's important that everybody is aware of the optimal way to do this, since high blood pressure is such a major risk factor for heart attacks and strokes, amongst other things. So we tilted that way. You know, what I've done is, fortunately, I still don't have high blood pressure, but I purchased for, I think it was around $35, a home machine that's quite accurate. I brought it in and compared it with what my physician got, and it was quite accurate. And it's something I can monitor at home in a much more comfortable environment.
Well, let's talk about the numbers that they give you, because they always tell me mine is excellent, but I never really understand what the numbers mean. There's the diastolic and the tell us
right.
What it is, what we need to know.
Right. Well, the top number is called systole, and that's the maximum pressure your heart needs to reach to pump the blood through the system. The bottom number, diastole, is the resting pressure in the heart after it's relaxed. So you want the top number to be below 120 for adults, and you want the bottom number to be below 80 for adults. And those would be normal blood pressures. It can be quite different than that. I mean, it can be, some people can be very normal at 90 over 55, but you want to make sure that it's below 120 over 80. Between 120 and 130 for the top number, systole, mm-hmm. or between 80 and 90 for the bottom number, is what we call pre-hypertension. It's not a disease, but people with pre-hypertension, people who are in that range, have a high probability of at some point going on to develop high blood pressure, and those people should be watched more closely. And then if you're above 140 for the top number and above 90 for the bottom number on a consistent basis, then you have high blood pressure. I want to emphasize, though, it's on a consistent basis because, as I mentioned earlier, our blood pressures are constantly fluctuating. So you don't want to take one measurement and say, this is where I am. You have to do many, many measurements over time.
If you know you're under a lot of stress on any given day and you happen to be going to the doctor's office for a previous scheduled appointment, and is it a good idea to tell the nurse or whoever's taking your blood pressure that I've had a really rough day today? I'm under a lot
sure.
of pressure. Just, do they care? Do they want to know about something like that?
Well, I'd hope they care.
Well, they may care on a personal level, but
right.
does it help them do their job to know that?
It does. It does, and it should. You know, even if you're not having a stressful day, just going into a doctor's office, mm-hmm. just having your blood pressure measured for a lot of people causes the blood pressure to go up. And for years, that's been called white coat hypertension. That means that when you're around somebody with a white coat on, your blood pressure goes up. And that's another good argument for doing home measurement to confirm that what's happening at home is what's happening in the doctor's office. But sure, tell them, look, this is a tough day for me. I've really been under a lot of stress. I've been drinking a lot of coffee or whatever. Mm-hmm. And so people know that you're really having, your blood pressure may be a little higher for that reason.
My guest is Dr. John Swartzberg. He's clinical professor of health and medical science at the University of California, Berkeley. He's also chair of the editorial board for the UC Berkeley Wellness Letter, news and expert advice from the School of Public Health. If you have a question or comment for him, give us a call, 614-292-8513. You can also email us at allsides@wosu.org. You can go to our Facebook page, post your question or comment there. We'll be right back. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
This is 89.7 NPR News. Thanks for joining us today. Are you hungry for more than just headlines and short sound bites about our community? Watch Columbus on the Record Friday nights at 8:30 on WOSU TV to get your fill of in-depth, thoughtful, and balanced analysis of the issues affecting Columbus and Central Ohio. Join host Mike Thompson and his guests to take on the issues of the day, anything from Columbus City Hall to Ohio as a battleground state for the 2012 elections. Watch Columbus on the Record. It's Friday nights at 8:30 on WOSU-TV. 78 degrees with a mix of sun and clouds in downtown Columbus. Partly sunny skies today, a high of 96. We do have a chance of a scattered shower. Also, an excessive heat warning in effect until 8 o'clock this evening. For tonight, a slight chance of showers, partly cloudy skies, a low of 74. Sunny and hot on Friday, a high of 99. All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
My guest is Dr. John Swartzberg. He's clinical professor of health and medical science at the University of California, Berkeley. He's also chair of the editorial board for the UC Berkeley Wellness Letter, news and expert advice from the School of Public Health. We'll have a link to that if you want to learn more about the Wellness Letter. Go to WOSU.org/allsides and learn more about it there. Linda and Powell, you're on the air. Welcome to the show.
Hi.
Hi.
My name is Linda.
Mm-hmm.
I have heard that various opinions about this, that one number is much more important than the other. In the blood pressure. Mm-hmm. Is that true, or is that just something that I've heard?
That's a great question. When I was in medical school, which was a long time ago now, we were taught that the top number was the most important, the systole. Mm-hmm. And then over the next 10-15 years, there was a lot of data coming out showing that the bottom number, diastole, was the most important. And for a long time, doctors paid more attention to that. The data most recently, over the last probably 20 years, it's pretty consistent that, and logically, both numbers are important. So if your top number is consistently high, but your bottom number is normal, you still have high blood pressure. And if your bottom number is high, and your top number is normal, you still have high blood pressure. So I think the answer is to pay attention to both numbers.
Okay, Linda? All right. Thanks for that call. 614-292-8513 is the number to call if you have a question or comment for our guest, Dr. John Swartzberg. In your column this month, in the Wellness Letter, you write about the issue of social epidemiology and the study of effects of social relationships and other kind of social factors on your health. Can you talk about that a bit? Is that something that should be that most of us can figure on our own?
Well, we can figure it to an extent on our own, but I think what is not well recognized and is so incredibly important is the power of relationships and the power of our connectedness in society and where we stand in the socioeconomic status. What I'm getting at is a body of literature that's been around now for about 40 years but has really received a lot of attention in the last 10 or 15 years. And that is, when we look at, well, let's take, for example, heart attacks and strokes. When we look at all the risks for heart attacks and strokes, we'll list things like high blood pressure that we've been talking about, smoking, high cholesterol, and so on. These are the known risk factors, a strong family history. All of these are known risk factors that we can plug into a formula, and they'll show that, gee, if you have several of these risk factors, you're at much higher risk for a heart attack or stroke than somebody who doesn't. When we look at studies like this, you can control for all of the things that we know are risk factors, and they'll account for, with this example again of heart attacks and strokes, around 50%. People will argue maybe it's 40% or 60%, but around 50% of all heart attacks and strokes are going to be related to these risk factors that we know about. But that means that almost half of the events are for reasons that we don't understand. And that's where this idea of social epidemiology comes in, or risk factors related to a lack of connectedness, a lack of standing in a socioeconomic environment, a lot of continued stressors because of that, things we don't really have a good handle on. Another way of looking at this is to say that an awful lot of the problems that we have, medical problems that we have, are related to things in terms of how we interact with each other and how we live in our society. This is a very rich area for work. One of my colleagues is doing fascinating work about children who live in a very stressful, low socioeconomic environment, but don't have any other risk factors that we know about. And he's starting to show now that after several decades, these children, even without a high cholesterol or high blood pressure or so on, now that they're adults, are at much higher risk for problems like heart attacks and strokes.
In the March Wellness Letter, there was an article about personality and its relationship with health issues, you know, like the question of whether it's true that type A people with aggressive, competitive, intense traits are at higher risk for heart disease, that sort of thing. Is that related to this?
It is related to this. At least we think it may be. But that literature about type A and type B is really, really very muddled. And although it was quite popular back in the 70s, mm-hmm. most of the data that we have more recently suggests that this really breaks down. So there's probably some connection between what you're mentioning and what I was just talking about, but it's pretty tenuous at this time, at least we think so.
Jill in Dayton, you're on the air. Welcome to the show, Jill.
Hey. Yeah. That's a real major problem. I've been losing a lot of weight, and I can't seem to gain anything. I lost about 5 pounds in about a month. I keep losing it. I was 112. Now I'm down to about 108.
Dr. Swartzberg? What? I know you can't diagnose over the
sure.
phone, but what should she do?
Sure. Well, I'm sure there are a lot of your listeners sort of shaking their head and saying, gee, I wish I had that problem, because as you're aware, and everybody's aware, obesity is such an enormous problem in our society. On the flip side, when you're having a problem like Jill is having, obviously the first step is to consult with your physician, because there are some problems that can account for this. A simple problem that's relatively easy to correct is high thyroid output or hyperthyroidism that causes unexplained weight loss even when you're continuing to eat the same amount. When you look at unexplained weight loss, though, most of the time it relates to people who are not eating enough calories to compensate for how many calories they're burning. So I don't know whether Jill is a runner or exercises a lot, but if that may be the case and not consuming sufficient calories, so it's terribly important that she looks at the amount of calories that she's consuming vis-a-vis how much exercise she's doing. If that seems to be pretty stable, then clearly the next step is talking with your physician. There are lots of other medical problems that can account for unexplained weight loss, and these are things that a physician can diagnose with her.
Does that help, Jill?
I don't exercise. That's the thing. No matter what I eat, mm-hmm. I can eat a whole cheesecake or anything that's got all the fatty foods, and I can't gain a pound.
Jill, have you been to a doctor?
Yeah. I go to a gynecologist, and they still not finding out why I can't gain weight.
Okay.
They have me on protein diet drinks,
okay.
and I can't gain a pound. I lose faster than I gain.
Hmm.
Well, Jill, it might be a good idea to consult with an internist. These are doctors who, this is an area more in their specialty. So that might be an approach that you could take.
All right, Jill, good luck with that. My guest is Dr. John Swartzberg, clinical professor of health and medical science at the University of California, Berkeley. He's also chair of the editorial board for the UC Berkeley Wellness Letter. An email from Pam, she says, is the wellness letter you are talking about something I can subscribe to via email? I would love to get this information to read. It is a lot to absorb right now. Dr. Swartzberg, can you tell folks how they can get a hold of the
Wellness Letter? It's wellnessletter.com, wellnessletters, one word, .com, and you can subscribe for either a print edition or for an electronic edition. Actually, one word about that, that I'm really proud of, and that is that all of the royalties that the School of Public Health at Berkeley gets for publishing the Wellness Letter go to our Masters of Public Health students in terms of scholarships and computer grants and so on. So it's been a major source of support for education at Berkeley for the last 25 plus years, and at the same time a major source of information for the public. So this is something we're real proud of, so I'd be delighted to have her subscribe.
Wellnessletter.com is the website, right?
Right.
Okay. And from Sarah on Facebook, she says, if my mom is very overweight and has problems with her blood pressure, do I need to worry? Is it inherited? I am not overweight and am very fit and active.
Blood pressure, there are instances where blood pressure runs in families. There's no question about that. But the good news is that even if it does run in families, by changing the way you behave, that is, how much food you consume, how much exercise you do, like it sounds like she does, can have a profound influence on preventing you from falling into the same line of events that happened to your mom or dad. So, yes, there is some genetic predisposition, but we have control over how our genes express. I might actually add to that. Salt intake. It's not just weight, and it's not just lack of exercise, but for a lot of people, the amount of salt we consume has a profound effect on our blood pressure.
Is salt addicting? I mean, some people use so much salt that we don't even put it on our table, but some people cover everything with it. Is it something that you develop a taste for and you become sort of addicted to?
Yeah, well, I addicted, no, because
that's a physical.
To our knowledge, there's no withdrawal.
Okay.
But habituated to it, okay. Yes. It's really interesting to look at the amount of salt consumed by Americans today and compare it to just one generation ago. We're consuming a lot more salt than we used to. So there's no question that there's a correlation between the amount of salt consumed over the last generation and problems attendant with that, primarily blood pressure. Now, one of the interesting things that a lot of people don't realize is that, sure, adding salt to your meal is a problem, but it's not the biggest problem. We get most of the extra salt that we don't really need through prepared foods. So when you go out and you get fast foods, when you go out to a restaurant, a fine restaurant, there's a lot of salt that's added. So I think that if you want to watch your salt intake, you want to be preparing your own foods most of the time and worry less about the salt shaker and more about how you're preparing your foods or how you're getting your foods. Now, to get to your specific question about this habituation to salt, the answer appears to be yes. We commented in the Wellness Letter about a year ago on a couple of really interesting studies that showed that people it took about anywhere from 3 to 6 weeks of reducing salt intake in food for people to accommodate mentally to that taste. By that I mean that after about 3 to 6 weeks of having a reduced salt diet, people no longer seem to want to add salt to their diet, and actually the foods that they thought tasted normal before that now tasted too salty. So it appears that we do get used to that salt taste, and that's something that we will come back to. And I guess teleologically arguing, it's not hard to understand that as we evolved, salt was a rare commodity for much of our species' existence. And so craving salt and trying to find it was important for our health.
That's the same with sugar, right?
Sugar is more complicated, but it appears to be very similar in terms of how we evolved. And foods with sugar tended to be foods with good caloric content, and so foods that we would go after. That's right.
My guest, once again, Dr. John Swartzberg, he's chair of the editorial board for the UC Berkeley Wellness Letter. If you have a question or comment for him, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. You can also go to the All Sides with Ann Fisher Facebook page and post your question or comment there. Dr. Swartzberg, in an article about the dairy diabetes debate, the discussion starts with debunking or
refers to Dr. Oz, the television, the guy on the television, and his opinions about nonfat milk. And I was wondering, I want to talk about the milk versus milk diabetes debate, but I was also wondering, do you find that with the proliferation of television doctors, real doctors, and medical advice columns, not to mention all the free online sources of medical information, that you're debunking or explaining or, you know, referring to those kinds of things a lot these days?
Yeah, well, it's really interesting in the era we live in. It's so exciting to have access to information on a near instantaneous basis. In my profession, the ability to find out what's going on at a moment's notice is just wonderful in terms of that access. And to get the backup literature electronically immediately is just absolutely wonderful. The flip side to that is that there's an awful lot of information out there, and most of it's not vetted carefully. And so people get exposed to a lot of information, and it's very hard for the layperson to tell in medical issues, is this solid data or is this really just fluff? And the same holds true for commentaries about health information that we hear on radios and televisions and in print a lot. And that is that if you have to have news every day, how good can that news always be? And if it has to be relatively sexy news in terms of health topics, things that will really interest people, how much is that going to alter the care in which you vet that material? I listen to health commentaries on the radio and television that are absolutely superb, that are really well vetted, solid information. And I listen to and read material that's quite the opposite. So it's real hard for listeners to really dissect out all of this. And coming back to this issue about milk and diabetes is a perfect example of that. It turns out that when one looks carefully at the literature, that some of the things that are said about milk and how much fat's in it, non-fat milk versus fat milk, and perhaps related to diabetes, there's some kernels of truth in the arguments, but tying each of these kernels together to reach a conclusion that was reached, for example, with diabetes and milk, there's just no good sound science to support that. And yet it gets on national media and gets purported, and people talk about that and start to worry.
My guest is Dr. John Swartzberg, clinical professor of health and medical science at the University of California, Berkeley, and chair of the editorial board for the UC Berkeley Wellness Letter. Questions or comments, 614-292-8513, or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org. We'll be right back. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
On Fresh Air, you'll hear revelations from well-known actors, like Zach Galifianakis on the story behind his last name.
It's actually shortened, Terry. My real last name is Galifianakisberg. that's an exclusive for your show.
Fresh Air, bringing you some of the biggest names in American culture and some of the most difficult to pronounce. Join us.
And Fresh Air begins in 20 minutes, starting at noon on 89.7 NPR News. On today's edition of Fresh Air, a discussion of the new Frontline documentary, Endgame, AIDS in Black America. Join us for that discussion, along with a review from jazz critic Kevin Whitehead, on Fresh Air from noon until 1 on 89.7 NPR News.
Support for 89.7 comes from Columbus School for Girls. Information about the academic curriculum in an all-girl environment is available at CSG's Summer Admission Coffee, Tuesday, July 10th. More information at columbusschoolforgirls.org.
For the latest from All Sides with Ann Fisher, be sure to visit our website, wosu.org/allsides. On the website, you can listen and watch the show live weekdays from 10 until noon. Also, be sure to explore the archive, which includes audio and video of every show. 79 degrees in downtown Columbus, partly sunny skies, a high of 96, an excessive heat warning in effect until 8 o'clock this evening. There are scattered showers and thunderstorms today and tonight, an overnight low of 74 degrees.
Mostly sunny and hot with a high of 99 for Friday. All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
My guest is Dr. John Swartzberg. He is chair of the editorial board for the UC Berkeley Wellness Letter. He's also clinical professor of health and medical science at the University of California, Berkeley. Questions or comments, 614-292-8513 or email us at allsides@wosu.org. Judy in Columbus, you're on the air. Welcome to the show, Judy.
Thank you.
You want to talk about hormone replacements?
Yes, please.
Okay, what's your question?
I'm a 42-year-old and have seen a doctor that's tested my blood and given me some cream, progesterone, and testosterone. So I'm not going through menopause. But I wanted to ask the doctor's opinion on pros and cons of estrogen or testosterone for both females and males.
Dr. Swartzberg?
Sure. Well, let's divide these up into estrogens and testosterones, and certainly estrogens have been in the news a lot for the last 15 years, really beginning in the 1990s with the or early 2000s with the Women's Health Initiative study that really shook us all up, because that's what showed that a strong correlation between intake of estrogens and breast cancer. This is an extremely controversial area where doctors who are well-versed in this, who've been doing research for their entire careers, can reach very different opinions. That said, the thinking today is that taking hormones, specifically estrogens, in the perimenopausal period, around the time of menopause or postmenopausal, appears to increase the risk of certain cancers, especially breast cancer. Again, I can't comment on your specific issue in terms of needing to take estrogen at this point, but there is the concern that taking exogenous or outside of your body estrogens can increase the risks for cancer. The issue about testosterone is one that is, there's an enormous amount of study currently happening on this. There's been data suggesting that the use of testosterone in females can increase libido. There's been data to suggest that that's not true. So there's quite a bit of controversy about the role of testosterone in terms of both premenopausal and postmenopausal use in females. So I guess the bottom line to your question is, this is something that you need to talk about with your physician, and it sounds like you already have. If you still have concerns or questions about that, that's a very good reason for getting a second opinion. So talking to a different doctor and perhaps getting another view of that. And if you have two well-qualified physicians agreeing that these are things you should be taking and you're well-versed as to the potential risks, then by all means, continue.
Judy, did that help?
Yes. Great.
All right.
Thank you.
Good. Thanks for your call. 614-292-8513. That's the number to call if you want to speak to my guest, Dr. John Swartzberg. Jean in Columbus, you're on the air. Welcome to the show. Jean, you want to continue the conversation about salt, huh?
Yes. I have been addicted to salt all my life, and I'm 69, so that's long addiction. And I was very interested in what the doctor said about it taking 6 to 12 weeks to kind of acclimate. What I do it without all this salt. What I wondered was, what would he recommend is the best way for me to try to go off of salt, cold turkey or ramping down?
And once again, it's not really an addiction, right, Dr. Swartzberg?
Right.
Yeah. Okay.
And it may take less than that, 6 to 12 weeks. The studies that I was talking about were, as I recall now, they were around 3 to 6 weeks. But nevertheless, it's a long time. I don't have an answer for you. No one, to my knowledge, has studied the question you're asking, which is an excellent question. I'll analogize to cigarettes. For most of the data with cigarettes cessation, which is truly an addiction, is that people tend to be more successful when they cold turkey. That said, there's a subgroup of people who do better when they taper. So if we can equate that to your habituation to salt intake, you could try one, and if that's not successful, you could try the other. Now, my intuition tells me that you can stop consuming salt, but you'll continue to have an appetite, and the worst-case scenario is that your food's going to taste more bland for a while. So it may not be really more of a problem than that for you. So in that sense, perhaps just stopping cold turkey may work very well for you and may certainly speed up the process of becoming less dependent upon it.
Because if it's not an addiction, there won't be a physical reaction to it. It's an emotional behavioral.
Well, more than emotional in the sense that it's going to be your food's going to taste like it has no flavor for a while.
Okay.
Yeah.
Jean, does that help?
I found one. They cut me off.
Okay. All right. 614-292-8513 or email us at allsides@wosu.org. Pat in Columbus, you're on the air. Welcome to the show.
Hello.
Hi, Pat.
My question is this. I approached high blood pressure over a period of some years, and when it was finally diagnosed, I went on a vegan diet, been there for a year. My numbers are all coming down, and triglycerides are down, and HDL is up, etc. How do I proceed to try to remove the blood pressure medication from my diet?
Well, congratulations on improving a lot of those numbers, because that probably will correlate with improved health. We've written quite a bit about vegan diets and myriad different types of diets that people consume. And vegan diets are very healthy. You have to make sure you're getting adequate B12, because that sometimes is a problem. So a B12 supplement, just as a multivitamin, may be reasonable. But they're very healthy diets, and they're clearly going to bring down for most people not only their weight, but their triglycerides and oftentimes the bad, quote, bad cholesterol, the LDL cholesterol. Whether or not vegan diets have an effect on blood pressure is more of a question mark. If you're overweight and you go on a vegan diet, you'll probably lose weight, and we know that being overweight is a contributor to high blood pressure, so it could help that way. But if it's not a weight issue, it's not clear that the vegan diet's going to have an effect on your blood pressure independent of salt. So I'm not sure if you're going to be able to improve your blood pressure on that basis. Now, all of that said, it would be nice to know if you really need to take that pill or not. And I think the way to do that, or at least one way to do that, and I've done this with lots of patients over the years, is to have them purchase a home monitor, have them keep their own record, and that talk to your physician and put together a strategy for how you will reduce the strength of your pill. So, for example, if you're taking 10 milligrams, you'll take 5 milligrams, mm-hmm. and see what happens to your blood pressure. And if over several weeks your blood pressure stays the same and doesn't go up, then reduce it further. And so tapering off and monitoring carefully, you and your doctor together can understand exactly what's happening, and you can see whether you can get off that pill.
Thank you. I think I understand exactly how to proceed.
Okay.
Great.
Bye.
Bye, Pat. Thanks for the call. 614-292-8513. That's the number to call if you want to speak with my guest, Dr. John Swartzberg. We've been talking about the UC Berkeley Wellness Letter. He is the chair of the editorial board for the Wellness Letter. We'll have a link to that. We do have a link to that on our website at wosu.org/allsides. Dr. Swartzberg also is a clinical professor of health and medical science at the University of California, Berkeley. Don in Cincinnati, you're on the air. Welcome to the show, Don.
Good morning. I was wondering if the doctor had any considerations for just supplemental vitamins, if there's any vitamins that he thought were really important for people to take, including some more of the more austere ones, or if he felt that some of the vitamins around are not useful, and in general, how does he feel about maybe some more popular ones, vitamin C and fish oil, those kinds of things.
Sure.
Dr. Schwartzberg.
Yeah, vitamins as supplements are an enormous industry in our society. The supplement industry in and of itself is somewhere between a $28 and $30 billion industry a year. So this is big money in the United States. It may surprise your listener to hear this, but there is no good science to suggest that human beings need to take a supplemental vitamin unless they are deficient in vitamins. And in the United States today, we live in this incredibly privileged era and country where everybody can get, most everybody, I should correct myself, not everybody, but most everybody can get pretty good nutrition with not a great deal of effort. But yet, most people, or at least close to 50% of people, take a multivitamin. And the studies that have been done looking long-term at people taking multivitamins have, as I said, not shown any prolonged life or better quality of life. And interestingly, a very important study out of Johns Hopkins two or three years ago showed all-cause mortality seemed to be higher in people taking multivitamins than not, although there was some criticism of that study. So I think the bottom line is we don't need to take multivitamins if we have a good, healthy diet. The second point is that we don't know a lot about, we know a lot about nutrition, but there's a lot more to know. And so taking these individual vitamins, thinking that they're going to help us, is an experiment that is not natural in the sense that we don't get our vitamins by taking individual vitamins. We get them by eating an apple or fruit or vegetables and so on. That's where we get our vitamins, or meat. We're doing a vast experiment on people when we say you need to take a supplemental vitamin C or supplemental vitamin D or supplemental vitamin E. So what I'm getting at here is that I would strongly focus on having a healthy diet and paying attention to eating nutritionally healthy foods and not worry about spending the money, even though it's not expensive, on multivitamins. More specifically, with the exception of vitamin D, I cannot find good science. None of our editorial board has found good science to support the consumption of vitamin C, vitamin E, beta-carotene, and so on. So I would encourage your listeners not to be supplementing with these things thinking they're improving their health. There's absolutely no data to suggest that. Vitamin D may be an exception. In today's New England Journal of Medicine, I haven't had a chance to review the article in depth, but it was a very good analysis by excellent researchers both in Switzerland and here in the United States, showing that 800 international units or more of vitamin D, at least in a large population, may prevent fractures in older adults. So there's right now a vitamin D bandwagon. Again, I would focus on trying to get sufficient vitamin D with your diet. It's a little difficult to do, and we don't like to encourage people to get vitamin D through sunlight. Our skin with sunlight converts, has chemicals in it that will convert to vitamin D. But sunlight, of course, can be a problem with skin cancer. So a lot of people may need to take a supplement of vitamin D, but that's still a question mark.
Thanks, Tom, for your question.
How about maybe CoQ10 or arginine or some of these more exotic ones?
Yeah,
same thing.
And same thing and more. There are no clinical studies to show that even people on statins who take CoQ10 live longer, have healthier lives. Arginine, there's no good clinical data to support the claims that are made. It's terribly important that you realize that these supplements are not approved by the FDA. They don't have to prove safety or efficacy or purity to be promoted and sold to the American public.
Thank you, Don, for your question. I appreciate it. Stephen in Newark, you're on the air. You want to talk about hepatitis C. Welcome to the show.
Nicole. I've been positive for hepatitis C for quite a long time. I got it in a blood transfusion sometime in the 80s. I've been through interferon therapy a couple times, and I'm not showing any symptoms, and my Hep C PCR assays have been negative for at least 10 years. And I just wonder, does this mean I'm really free of the virus at this point? And I haven't really gotten a great answer from that from any of the doctors I've asked.
Sure. It's a great question. Unfortunately, you have a lot of company. Hepatitis C, chronic hepatitis C is the most common chronic type of hepatitis in the United States today. The exciting news about hepatitis C is that particularly in the last 3 to 5 years, with the new medications we have, we think we're curing people. So I think you're in that category. We've been reluctant to say cure, and so the doctors have been using the phrase sustained virologic response, which means that for at least 5 years, we can't find any evidence that you're still infected, as you gave the example with the PCR test. That's very exciting. Today, because of these new drugs and because these sustained virologic responses are going well beyond 5 years, in your case, 10 years, my colleagues who are experts in hepatitis C are now starting to use the C word, that is the cure word. And we're starting to say that somebody who's gone 5 years or more without any PCR evidence of the virus in their blood is probably cured.
What about people who have been diagnosed with hepatitis C but still, without being treated for it, have no symptoms, are in maybe their second or third decade with it and still no symptoms?
Yeah, thank you for asking that question. It's really an important one because hepatitis C, chronic hepatitis C is, like chronic hepatitis B, is a silent disease until it causes life-threatening problems. And that can take several decades. And the two major life-threatening problems from hepatitis C are cirrhosis, or scarring of the liver, where our liver can no longer function. And the other is liver cancer. Both hepatitis B and hepatitis C, when they're chronic, can lead to that. And unfortunately, because people don't have symptoms, it doesn't prompt them to seek out medical care. And then, of course, what the doctor is going to say to you, you have chronic hepatitis C, and we have a medication that we think can cure you, but the medication has to be taken for a good while. It's going to be very expensive, and it may make you feel pretty rotten for a while. Mm-hmm. And you're going to say, wait a second, I feel fine, and you're going to give me something that's going to cost me a lot of money and is going to make me feel sick for a long period of time. And that's hard to digest for a lot of people. But it's terribly important that if you have risk factors for hepatitis C, like what Stephen said, he got it through a transfusion or for injectable drug use or whatever, if you have risk factors for hepatitis C, get checked to make sure you're not chronically infected. And if you are, the good news is that you probably can be cured.
Thank you, Stephen, for that question. We are out of time. I want to thank my guest, Dr. John Swartzberg, clinical professor of health and medical science at the University of California, Berkeley. Thanks for joining us, Dr. Swartzberg.
It was my pleasure. Thank you.
Once again, for more information on the Wellness Letter, go to our website at WOSU.org/allsides. Thanks to the All Sides staff, associate producer Amy Jurevich, intern Corinne Gleckler, volunteers Rachel Ramey and Andrew Sweet. Thanks for listening. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher. This is WOSU 89.7, WOSU HD1 Columbus, streaming online at WOSU.org. 89.7 NPR News, a service of WOSU Public Media.
Support for 89.7 comes from Columbus School for Girls. Information about the academic curriculum in an all-girl environment is available at CSG's Summer Admission Coffee, Tuesday, July 10th. More information at columbusschoolforgirls.org.